Israel for 5 decades. As editor of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazines and as a member of the International Cafe Society, she chronicled the extraordinary people and events of her time. This play is a portrait of Ree Land at a turning point in her life. Again, that's Full Gallop, now through October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboot.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I told you about Strawberry Field. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go.
The time is 11:30 on KBOO Portland. Up next is Madness Radio. And happy birthday to beloved Portland clown Olive of Olive and Dingo. Up next is Madness Radio.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Jax McNamara. Jax is a genderqueer writer and artist and healer based in the Bay Area. Jax co-founded the Icarus Project and is the subject of the documentary film Crooked Beauty. Jax has just published a new book of poetry, In Between Land. So welcome to Madness Radio, Jax McNamara.
Thanks so much, Will. I'm really glad to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. This is actually the second interview that I did with you. We did an interview, I guess, about 8 years ago, was it?
Yeah, 8 years ago.
when the Icarus Project was sort of just getting started, and now Icarus has celebrated its 10th anniversary. You and Sasha DeBruhl, the co-founder of Icarus, are going to be touring to celebrate that 10th anniversary and your book release, right?
Indeed. We're taking both of our new solo books and a reissue of Navigating the Space Between Brilliance and Madness on the road for a month this spring.
And tell us a little bit about the Icarus Project.
I like to talk about the Icarus Project as a collaborative adventure in mutual aid. Started the project for people living with the conditions that are usually called psychiatric diagnoses, looking at those conditions as sort of dangerous gifts to be taken care of and cultivated instead of looking at them as diseases and disorders that need to be cured. And so at this point, the project is many things. It's a many-headed hydra. There's an online community with thousands and thousands of members talking to each other about all kinds of things and posting articles and art galleries on the Icarus website. And then there are local support groups all over the world, as far-flung as Argentina and Arkansas, all over the place. And then we also put out a number of alternative publications, one of which is your Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psych Drugs, which the Icarus Project co-publishes. And then we have a few other publications that are getting translated into all kinds of languages. It's pretty exciting these days.
And I should say that this is one of the things that really attracted me to getting involved and becoming an organizer with the Icarus Project is the emphasis on creativity and the positive side. And so if people haven't seen the absolutely gorgeous website that you designed, theicarusproject.net, they should definitely check that out. And your sort of artistic visionary leadership has been a big part of developing that community. And tell us about the new book of poetry that you've just released.
So the book of poetry is called In Between Land. It sort of chronicles a period of my life over the last, gosh, I guess almost 7 years now since my mother died. And I didn't start it intending it that way. It was just lots and lots of poems I was writing. And then after self-publishing some of them and performing a lot, I got invited by a brand new press called Deviant Type, which is a radical publishing collective. They called me up one day on the phone and asked if I'd be willing to publish a book with them, which is sort of every writer's dream, to not have to submit anything and then have someone just call you up one day. So I said yes. And then I've spent the last year and a half working on bringing this book together and really finding the shape of what it's trying to talk about, which is really about transformation and healing.
And Jax, how did all this get started? How did you first get engaged with mental health issues from your own personal story? And then what has been the role of art and creativity in your own process of transformation around that?
So I grew up in Virginia. I'm adopted, and I grew up with a family that meant well, but did me a lot of harm. And I had a lot of, quote, mental health issues from a young age. I was a very volatile, intense, depressive, elated, creative, brilliant, devastated child, teenager, adult. I mean, the way I formally got involved in the mental health system was when I was 19, and I had had a few months where I was certain that I'd figured out how to save the world, quite literally, through teaching everybody about the interconnections of the carbon in their bodies that came from exploded supernovas. And somehow if I taught everybody about this, it was going to end racism, classism, and poverty.
Goals which you have not necessarily given up at this point, though, right?
Yeah, no, I'd love to see that happen. I just don't think I'm going to do it single-handedly. Yeah, that's part of why the Icarus Project is there and other grassroots activism. We need a lot of people working on these things.
Yeah, the isolation is often the key thing that gets us into trouble. The visions are great. It's just when we're alone with them, so...
Right, and learning to get along with other human beings.
What was it that got you to that point of having this incredible, I'm going to save the world single-handedly vision or drive or passion that you had that got you locked up?
It's an interesting question. I mean, there are a lot of ways to answer it. You know, I think one is that I've just always had an acute sensitivity to injustice. And, you know, I've just never been a person with a lot of filters who can block out both the beautiful and the terrible aspects of the world. You know, from the age of being a young kid, I mean, I remember when I would see my mom saying racist things or see bad things happen on television, like I needed to call them out. I needed to talk about them. I needed to figure out how we could end them. So one was just this acute sensitivity, and then a really creative mind that wanted to problem solve.
At what point did that really become an extreme state that got you into being locked up?
I think a lot of it had to do with drugs and alcohol. In the 6 months before I got locked up, I had dropped out of college and I was traveling around the world and doing a lot of different drugs and drinking a lot. And, you know, I was kind of thinking that I was like a queer American Jack Kerouac taking on Europe and Egypt. You know, it was a wild ride. While I was there, I ended up getting fired from a number of jobs and then working at a chicken factory and just having experiences where I really saw sort of the underbelly of capitalism.
Working in a chicken factory, like a factory farm of chickens?
No, a factory that packs chickens. At one point, I ended up, living in a trailer park on a farm for temporary workers and getting sent out to factories as a temp worker, one of which was a chicken factory, which was a seminal experience in my life in terms of overwhelming my system and really committing me to be an anti-capitalist.
It definitely seems like a significant stressor for contributing to an extreme state.
Yeah, hardcore. So when I got back from that trip, I was pretty opened up in all kinds of ways, pretty overwhelmed in all kinds of ways. I just climbed Mount Sinai. Like, I'd just done all these incredible things. And it was kind of more than my system could hold together, combined with a lot of just trauma in my background. And I feel like it all finally erupted into what started out, you know, the extreme states started out amazingly. I mean, I really thought I'd figured out the key to human salvation, you know, but when the wheels came off, the wheels came off. And when everything started to fall apart and degenerate, it was just a horrible black mess of chaos and nasty inner voices and not being able to function in consensus reality at all. And I ended up in the psych ward.
And so you said that trauma was part of this mix as well. What kinds of trauma do you mean? Or how is it that that played a role?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There were types of trauma I knew about and types of trauma I didn't that end up coming up in my book. I was raised in a really alcoholic family, a really raging, unsafe, neglectful, I hate to overuse the word crazy, but yeah, a very chaotic, turbulent family. And I held a lot of unresolved pain and isolation from that. I'm also adopted, which I didn't think contributed in any way to my life problems. I was always told that being adopted doesn't make a difference. But I've come to realize later that it makes a huge difference, you know, that I was given away at birth to strangers. And then in the last 6 or 7 years of my life, the time period that I chronicle in this book, I've had a lot of memories of childhood sexual abuse and other sexual assault resurface in my life, including during that trip I was talking about when I was in Europe and in Egypt. I was actually assaulted in Egypt, which I completely blocked from my memory for 6 years.
So these experiences really, you know, drove your creativity, and they also drove you're becoming a healer, because I know that you're now practicing as someone who does somatic, generative somatics healing work with people, which is a very sophisticated body-oriented way of addressing trauma. And we actually interviewed Stacey Haynes talking about this for people who are interested in this.
And yeah, it's definitely one of the things that's led me there. You know, it's something that we talk about a lot in Icarus, is the archetype of the wounded healer, and that it's through walking through the fire yourself that you end up knowing how to help other people walk through it, you know? And I definitely, a lot of my work in the world, whether it's my writing, whether it's my art, whether it's now doing direct healing work, has been motivated by trying to help people in ways that there was no one to help me, trying to fill the voids that I saw, to write the book that I needed that wasn't there when I was 15, or provide the kinds of like radical trauma-informed healing practice that I was not able to access when I was 19, you know, that kind of thing.
So will you read one of the poems from your new book? This is from your new book, In Between Land.
Yes, and I'm actually going to read from the title poem, In Between Land. It's quite a long poem, so I'm just going to excerpt a few sections. In Between Land. I wish someone had told me I would get out of the burning house, or that I had already escaped a long time ago, and it lived on only in my muscles and my mind. I wish someone had handed me the word survivor, placed it in my palms like a blossom or a drill, told me to build altars and hang hinges carefully. I wish they had told me I could stand up any time, open the door, leave. My best friend and I used to talk about choosing earth and sky. We traveled between borders leading workshops for survivors who had known rocks that whisper, billboards who shout conspiracies and cosmic truths, electric hearts impaled on apocalypse sunsets over ruined cities and paper mountains speaking myths that evaporate like water off hot pavement when you finally come down into the world of toothpaste and toilet paper. Fathers and sons, appointments, diagnoses, mania, psychosis, but we knew. We were caught trying to fly out of mazes built by kings and corporations, where your wings melt once you finally make it over the sea. When we mentioned keeping one foot in both worlds, everyone in the room would exhale, eyes like fireflies switching on at dusk. Permission. This too is real. In between land. Both. You don't have to choose between sanity and the roofless night. It's 2012 and I am lying on the floor of a small room while a therapist in a black muscle tee emblazoned with hope in white letters draws infinity symbols above my eyes. I follow her fingers and I freeze as usual until the images come. The shadow shapes of men, my father leaning over, thick stories, heat, suddenly, the impulse to roll onto my side, stand up, open the door, leave. For the first time, I do. Outside, the world is big as snow, bright as a waxing moon, full of people. My hands are full of tools, my eyes full of horizon. I am enormous, a child landing in an adult's miraculous skin.
Such a powerful image of somehow balancing both and having a foot in both worlds and not being swept up in madness, but also not being trapped in being in the prison either, that there's something right about the impulse of wanting to get away from just ordinary reality. It really resonates with me. And one of the things that you talk about a lot in your poetry, Jax, is being queer and identifying and experiencing the world in a way very different than people around us do. And that's something that I think, you know, played a big role in my own trauma, being targeted for my own sexuality, and also that sense of not fitting in, and where am I? If I'm not in the straight world, and I'm not in the gay world, then where am I? And tell us something about your own development of that identity and that sense of yourself, and really embracing your sexuality and your gender and all of its complexity and its richness.
There's so much to say. I mean, it's interesting. So when you knew me, I was still sort of bouncing back and forth between kind of trying to be straight very unsuccessfully, and then being in queer relationships, and then kind of freaking out. And I was not in a place of acceptance around my own gender identity and my own queerness. You're in my a poem telling me that I've always had a third gender energy.
I don't actually know this poem, so please read it.
Third gender. One. I remember when I turned my last skirt into a tablecloth, because I only wanted to be one gender now, and it was not girl. I remember when everything changed, I turned the tablecloth back into a skirt. Two, the red purse was the last present my mother ever gave me. I hid it under the bed, and then I got sober and she went into a coma. It was easier to look like a girl when I went back to Virginia. The neighbors liked me with long hair. The purse was actually pretty and had good pockets. I carried it to the hospital every day. Three. When I was 17, I wrote a short story about castrating cucumbers. After cars of drunk men threw packs of playing cards at me, Queen of Hearts, Ace of Spades, they swerved directly at me, 2 a.m., screamed at my tits. When I cut all my hair off 2 days later, I felt hideous and proud, properly gay and partly invisible. No one's screaming now but my mom. Four. They called me Sinead O'Connor. They called me G.I. Jane. They called me crazy and called me sir when I shaved my head in a foreign country. Small children asked if I was a boy or a girl. The men shouted out shop windows to ask where my hair was. Finally, I gave up and told them I sold it to buy my plane ticket home. They stopped asking me why I wasn't married. They stopped asking me anything at all. Five. We had gone to my mother's favorite restaurant and drunk enough wine to be pleasant. We were supposed to be celebrating something. When we got home, she burst into tears all over the kitchen counter. All she was thinking at dinner that night was she hoped everyone thought I'd had chemotherapy, and that's why I had no hair. Six. He told me I'd always had a lot of third gender energy before I knew what that meant. He thought it was a compliment. I thought I was an alien. I don't remember another word he said. I remember going home, putting on a black dress, and trying to be beautiful. Seven. Now my lover tells me I am handsome, and she tells me I am pretty. Sometimes I open my ribs for her. I bought a black tuxedo vest on eBay. It has one rhinestone button. I will wear it. She will wear a short skirt and a flower in her hair. She calls me her ex-boyfriend and she calls me a zebra. She squeals when she discovers my underwear is still covered in hearts.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. Today, my guest is Jax McNamara. Jax is a genderqueer writer and artist and healer based in the Bay Area. Jax co-founded the Icarus Project and is the subject of the documentary film Crooked Beauty. Jax has just published a new book of poetry, In Between Land. And I think in terms of the world starting to really move beyond the straight and gender binary either or, and the oppression of something that's not in line with the mainstream, there is a recognition that, look, being different, being unusual, being part of a sexuality or a gender identity that isn't the mainstream, it doesn't mean that you're more, have more problems, or you're more sick or more neurotic or anything like that. That's the sort of the old story that we've been told, and we're beyond that now. And at the same time, I'm really curious what your sense is. What is the relationship between being queer and madness?
The answer is it depends. It depends on a person's life experience. You know, there are people these days, some who grow up with really nice, loving, liberal families who accept them however they are and grow up in really nice, progressive communities where it's fine to be a gender variant child. And then they probably still experience a lot of oppression out in the world, a lot of transphobia and, you know, homophobia. But that's getting better depending where you live. but it really depends, you know? I mean, most of the folks I know who are queer who have mental health issues, you know, part of it, it's not because queer gives anyone a mental health issue. It's because being queer in this world and the things you deal with might pile a lot of trauma on your plate. You know, I dealt with a lot of homophobia and sort of trans or gender phobia stuff from family out in the world. You know, that trip I was talking about before I got locked up the first time, that's the stanza of the poem where I talk about shaving my head in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. And everywhere I went, it was just like getting yelled at and asked if I was a boy or a girl, getting things thrown at me, just like lots and lots and lots of harassment, you know, and always being very, very vigilant, like always knowing that you probably weren't safe, always trying to have your back covered, always being aware of who might come at you, whether or not it was safe to talk about who you were in a relationship with, whether or not it was safe to walk down the street, whether who you had to pretend to be. You know, it wasn't like I could rest in the world if I looked gender variant. So I think that those legacies of dealing with just like harassment, abuse, and oppression, yeah, they've had a big effect on my mental health. And then also like just trying to find a place to belong, just trying to find my experiences reflected. You know, I came of age as a queer person in rural Maryland. I tried to start a gay straight alliance at my high school and was told that I couldn't do it because people would pull their kids out of the school. You know, so there was no Ellen. There was no famous gay person to look at or non-famous gay person. It was just completely closeted and terrifying. And you thought everybody was going to kick you out, which partly happened to me if you came out as being queer.
I also think that's been a big theme of the Icarus Project's work, has been pointing to oppression as itself something that causes psychosis, madness, extreme states, whatever you want to call it, that trauma isn't just something that happens individually or in the families, but it also needs to be understood as a social, institutional, historical force. And that's really crucial. And at the same time, there's something very powerful about queerness and about moving between genders and moving beyond genders, and the ways in which the healers and the shamans and the medicine people in traditional cultures are often the ones that are themselves transgressing genders.
It opens you up to a lot of different sides of human experience. I'll talk about something that forces you to move between worlds.
And Jax, is this also part of why you chose the title In Between Land?
Well, you know, In Between Land kind of chose me. It's funny. It's something I started writing about very shortly after you made that comment to me about the third gender energy. And I just started chewing on in my life what it's like to be someone who walks between worlds. And then when I was choosing between different potential titles for the book, eventually I came back to that, you know, 7 years later and was like, that's it. That's the title. Like, this is where I live, is this in-between world. And as much as I try to pick a side to be in and say, this is my side, there isn't a side, there isn't a box or a category that fits. And so how do we learn to just live in between land? And I mean, it's still an ongoing struggle for me daily, but yeah, that's kind of where I think I am and where a lot of power is. You know, this culture has a lot of boxes I don't want to fit into.
And does that impulse, that source, or that inspiration that makes that art come forward, that poetry come forward, is it the same impulse, do you think, that can take us too far and that leads us into madness?
Definitely related. I don't know if there's like one, you know, or the other, to be all in between land on you, but definitely they are very closely related to each other, you know. And in the middle of writing this book, I lost my mind again. I ended up locked up in a psych ward last summer, which I could not believe after 13 years.
What happened? Maybe I should say, what was going on in between land and also not going on in between land?
You know, so I'd been working on this book, which brought up a ton of intense material and required me to be, you know, alone with my tortured, tempestuous, beautiful muse. That doesn't lead to the most mental stability that anyone's ever seen. I developed RSI, repetitive strain injury, in my wrists and my hands and my arms and my back and my neck, horribly, horribly. And before I ended up having the crisis last summer, like, I'd had to quit work completely. I'd been dealing with it for a year and a half and hadn't found anything that made it better for more than a couple weeks. Chronic illness and chronic pain can really do your head in.
What was it that helped you get out of that space of so much pain and extreme state and being back in the psychiatric hospital to where you are now with publishing the book and touring and doing the work that you do?
a number of things. One of them, honestly, is medication. I went through the horrible rigmarole of trying a bunch of different meds. Over the years, I've become way more sensitive to side effects, and I can't take the things that used to be helpful. But we finally found something I'd never tried that worked incredibly well once it kicked in. It was like the negative black voice, hysteria, suicidal despair. It just stopped. And it wasn't like my life was fabulous.
And what was that medication?
Trileptal. It's an anticonvulsant. It's one that's pretty experimental with bipolar. It's not super well studied. It's one of the reasons I'd never tried it. But I have pretty much no side effects, and it's been super helpful. And it wasn't like I took it and then, woof, my life is fabulous. It was like I took it, and then I could think again clearly enough to see the steps I would need to take to put my life back in order.
I think this is really related to that image of in-between land, that if we're either or, either meds bad or meds good, then we miss the reality of the situation, is that often it's not an either or, that, you know, you may feel like, oh, I wish I wasn't on meds. I wish I wasn't on meds. But if you find that they're useful for you, and that's what makes the bridge to get out from where you are to where you want to be, then absolutely, that's the useful tool that you find. And I think often people get stuck in that either or consciousness that just, you know, doesn't work in either direction. So
totally. And I do. I mean, I'd much rather not be on them long term. You know, my life goal at this point, well, I had this whole plan where by the time I was 32, I was going to be off meds. I was going to have been off them for a couple years. I was going to have a partner and be getting ready to think about having kids in the next couple years and be ready to be pregnant. And I was going to be off my meds so it would be safe for me to be pregnant. That was the plan. You know, and I worked very hard on that plan. You know, I went to acupuncture. I did all kinds of alternative healing. I thought I'd found the right partner. Like, it didn't work. So I'm trying to see the gifts now in my life going another direction. You know, I was able to go away for the winter and finish this book, you know, and I've been able to take these steps to put my life back together, to get my health back in order and, you know, look towards what am I going to do next.
Yeah, in-between land doesn't really work well with linear plans and expectations. The flexibility is so important. And I often think in the Icarus story, you know, there is this wisdom of getting cautioned by the parental figure, the father figure, the, you know, the mainstream voice sometimes has some really important things to offer us. And we need to not be in one world or the other. We need to be somehow in both worlds, and taking the wisdom and taking the tools and taking the practical solutions where we find them, with a flexible point of view, rather than being anti-medications.
Like, I still think that if there was a beautiful med-free sanctuary I could have gone to, for example, if I had a sugar mama in the sky to foot my bills after I got out so I didn't have to work for 6 months, I didn't have to worry about keeping down a job, paying my rent, keeping my life together. Like, I don't think that going on the meds is like a necessity, but in this world, that's the piece for me. I'm in this world. I wish I was in the world I want to be, where someone would put me out, feed me organic food, take me hiking, and I'd have a great Jungian-inspired psychotherapist with somatics background to help me spend 2 years working out the existential dilemmas that underlie my madness. I wish that was there. It's not. I don't have the resources to create it. Like, I need to keep functioning in consensus reality. No one's going to pick me up and carry me. And for me, that's a lot of the meds come in, as like the tool that currently exists to give me some filters and to give me some stability so I can put one foot in front of the other.
If you did have the absolutely ideal circumstances, would there be absolutely no need for something like medications or something like confinement?
You know, and we can't know the answer.
Maybe we can't. And one of the things that we can look at is historically, like if you look at all these different cultures around the world, there's something about madness that doesn't seem to want to go away, and it never wants to be controlled. It never wants to be understood. There's always been wild people who've been, even in ideal, if we romanticize indigenous cultures, even we say, well, they had a place, they were recognized. Sometimes not. Sometimes they just killed them. You know, sometimes they just drove them out. And sometimes people just wandered or did whatever it is they did and ended up having a terrible, terrible, tragic outcome.
It's deep. And I mean, I think some of this stuff is like intergenerational. And, you know, I think it comes from way back. Like, I think I carry some trauma that is not my own. I was born to a woman who knew she had to give me away. The entire time I was in her womb, she knew she was going to give me away. She was unemployed. She was stressed out. Her super Christian parents were pressuring her to get rid of a child that she didn't mean to have. you know, and then here I come into the world and like I deal with a lot of depression. I deal with a lot of feeling like I don't belong on this planet. I deal with a lot of anxiety about work and money. And I come from a family where biologically, so my biological dad found me when I was 21. He's diagnosed bipolar. His brother was diagnosed schizophrenic. I have multiple other family members who I won't name for their confidentiality and privacy, who've also been diagnosed bipolar, like all in my biological family. And I never met them until I was 21. It's not like they raised and imparted into me a bunch of behaviors through the environment I was in. You know, and I don't know what to make of that. Like, I've sort of developed a complex idea of inheritance, like what it means for madness to be inherited, quote unquote. I think it means a lot of things.
So whether that's the artist gene or the creative gene or the madness gene, I don't know if we're ever going to be able to figure that
out. Right, you know, and they're all really creative people. Like, they're also all creative, beautiful, fascinating, turbulent, smart people, you know.
That was something that John Weir Perry, the Jungian, said. He said if they did find a gene for schizophrenia, it would be the gene for creativity. Even if you're sensitive to the eugenics of it and the way that genes have been used as an argument to make people powerless and feel like they can't do anything and they just have to surrender for their fate, even if you do recognize all that, you know, maybe we should be open to it. There's something mysterious going on here and there's a lot of unknowns.
I think about it as inheriting a certain pattern of stress response. Even if I do think there's a piece that's, quote, inherited, I don't think that makes it a disorder or a dysfunction. I think it's, you know, like, I am totally happy to say I came into this world as a sensitive kid.
I like that image of sensitivity because, you know, being more sensitive isn't necessarily weakness or greater vulnerability. It just means that it's a diversity thing. It's like, well, you're more sensitive, so different kinds of situations, you know, you're going to respond to them differently than other people. But sensitivity is an incredible asset and a positive thing in other situations. Jax, how can people get in touch with you and find out more about your work and see some of your artwork and also buy copies of your new book, In Between Land?
The way to find out more about me and my work in the book is to go to my website, which is www.redwingedjaxbird.net. It's like red winged blackbird, but redwingedjaxbird.net. You can also Google my name. It comes right up. And to find out more about the tour that we're doing this spring, go to the Icarus Project, which is www.theicarusproject.net.